Today is the first day of class, January 11th, 2018. We're going to talk about some introductory endocrine system information today. All right, so we're going to start out with endocrine system. This system is actually kind of a tie-over from nervous system in Bio-210. So I'd like to take you back to Bio-210 for just a moment. Bio-210 is probably the last thing that you had in terms of nervous system information. So tell me how the nervous system, how it operates. How does one nerve cell tell another nerve cell to do something?
Neurotransmitter,
good. And how fast is that?
Very fast.
Very fast, yeah. So fast that you have already had the nerve transmission before you can even tell me the answer, right? So we're talking about split second fast. Well, the endocrine system works with chemical messengers similar to neurotransmitters, but they're not necessarily in a hurry. So we're not looking for a fast controlling system when we talk about the endocrine system. We're actually working on a slower controlling system when we talk about the endocrine system. All right, so neurotransmitters are, of course, the mode of communication for the nervous system. The mode of communication for our endocrine system is hormones. I'm going to change the resolution on my screen. It'll black out for just a moment. So if you were standing on that railroad track with that train barreling towards you, you would want your nervous system to be the one to move you off.
Yeah.
The endocrine system would be like, oh yeah, here comes a train. Minute later, the hormone may get to your target. Minute later, good gosh, you know, that's not the system, right? So the endocrine system relies on the transport of hormones through the bloodstream. And it takes a minute for your blood to make a full route from the heart, around your body, and back to the heart. Obviously, your endocrine system's job is not meant to be a fast-acting system. Let me give you another example here. When babies are born, they're on average like 20 inches long. And when we grow to our final height, you know, if you're, say, 5 feet tall, that's 60 inches. You know, if you're 6 feet tall, you're looking at, like, what, 72 inches tall? And you have from the day that you're born until maybe 15, 18, maybe even 20 years old to grow from 20 inches to over, say, 60 inches in height. That's, you know, a lot of years to grow about 40 or 50 inches. That's your endocrine system at work. And that's hormones driving that growth process. So obviously we're not looking at this being a fast action process. We're looking at most of our hormone activities being a longer term, more of a maintenance type thing, and not a quick resolution. Okay. So of course, neurotransmitter picture here. Do you recognize this picture? Okay. Got an axon terminal, right? There's your synaptic cleft. And what was necessary for that neurotransmitter to communicate with the neighboring cell? ACH, right? And what did it bind to? Yeah, channel, right? Yep, sodium channel. So there's that little receptor site sitting on that sodium channel. So just something to kind of appreciate that neurotransmitters and hormones are both chemical messengers. It's how they get to their target areas is making them different. Neurotransmitters travel across a synaptic cleft. How do hormones get to their targets? Bloodstream, that's right. Okay, we'll come back to that thought in just a moment. I just wanna make sure that before we go any further, we see the difference between endocrine and exocrine glands. You know, without even reading anything about them, look at the prefix. What does endo tell you?
Inside.
Within, inside, and exo?
Outside.
Outside. And so sweat glands, oil glands, tear glands would be classified as
exocrine,
right? And things like thyroid gland, pancreas, you know, ovaries, testes, those make hormones for the inside. Now, you'll notice structurally there's a difference here between the two. Which one of these needs a duct or a tube to transport substances out?
Exocrine.
We don't need tubes inside our body for hormones to travel. They don't do so simply by diffusion. So how does that work?
You should go where it's needed.
Go where it's needed, right. High concentration to... low concentration, that's it. So no tubes or duct work needed there for endocrine glands. Let's see. I'm looking to see that how many of you all do not have course packs. Maybe I should come back to this picture when you do have a course pack. Okay. If you do have one, I'll go ahead and give you the labels here today. Let's see. Letter A in the brain is pineal gland. And I know that print is tiny up there on the screen. It's spelled P-I-N-E-A-L. Okay, letter A is pineal gland. Letter B is posterior pituitary gland. Letter B is posterior pituitary gland. All right, letter C is anterior pituitary gland. Notice letter D is in the neck, wrapped around the trachea. Which one is that?
Thyroid.
Thyroid. Okay, thyroid is D. Down here in the chest for letter E is which one?
Thymus.
Thymus, good. So D is thyroid, E is thymus. All right, F are adrenal glands. G is pancreas. And then we've got H, ovaries, and I, testes. If you don't have a course pack, you may want to snap a picture of this or write down those letters so that you've got them to transfer when you do get one. So that does page 3 for us. How about questions so far? So far, so good? Okay. Anybody still need this slide? Top of page 4 has a definition for hormones. We know that they are chemical messengers. So they're kind of like neurotransmitters, but they get to their targets in a different way. They don't travel across a synaptic cleft. They travel through the bloodstream. Okay, so that means that their journey is going to take a bit longer to get to their target organs. Like long awkward pauses. I'm just checking to see if you're still jotting down notes. Anybody still need this screen? Yeah, good. Okay. All right. So here's the deal. We're gonna have to go back to Bio-210 for just a moment and think about how membranes are constructed. And the reason that that's important is because hormones come in two different varieties. Hormones may either be amino acid based, which means they're protein hormones, or hormones may be steroid based, which means they're lipid based hormones. So the type of hormone that we're dealing with matters for how it communicates with its target organ. I should mention that the majority of our hormones fall into the protein category. The only hormones classified as steroids are adrenal cortex hormones and sex hormones. Okay, so the only hormones classified as steroids are adrenal cortex hormones and sex hormones. Okay, so the majority of our hormones are protein-based. The only ones classified as steroids are adrenal cortex hormones and sex hormones. Okay, so back in Bio210, you guys probably talked about the plasma membrane structure. And we know it's made up of two layers of what? Phospholipids, good. We know those phospholipids are a bit picky. We know that they have heads and tails. The heads are water what? Water loving. And the tails on the inside? Are water fearing, good. So that's something we talked about quite often in Bio210. One thing we don't really mention so much is this. Those tails, because they hate water, actually love fat. So anything that is fat-based can come through your phospholipid bilayer, and those tails say, hey, you're just like us, come right on through. Now if you're water-based, that's a different story. Those tails say, you're not coming through our territory here. Thinking about that and our two types of hormones, which one do you think can come directly through the phospholipid bilayer? Steroids, yeah. So those adrenal cortex hormones and those sex hormones that come from ovaries and testes come right on through. Okay, so they're invited right on in. Protein-based hormones, well, they kind of have a problem. They're big. And we know that only small items can travel through the phospholipid bilayer, and that big items like a protein can rip a hole in your phospholipids. So unfortunately, what that means is proteins cannot just sneak through like the lipids do. They're going to be stuck on the outside of your plasma membrane. Okay, so they're never going to come through the way that those lipids do. Now, that takes us to the two methods that these hormones use to communicate with their target organs. Proteins use something called a secondary messenger system, and lipids use a method called direct gene activation. Now, I should also point out to you, if you do have a course pack today, there is always an exception to the rule, right? We say that proteins use secondary messenger, and we say lipids use direct gene activation. But the exception is this. Thyroxine, that's a hormone made by your thyroid gland that regulates metabolism. It's a protein, but which system does it use? Direct gene, yep, so that's our exception here. Thyroxine is a protein. Thyroxine is a protein, but it uses direct gene activation. Thyroxine is a protein, but it uses direct gene activation. Okay, so thyroxine is a protein, but it uses direct gene activation. So let's talk through how proteins talk to their target cells. First of all, let's go back for just a moment. Let me backtrack through a few pictures here. This picture shows the axon terminal, a synaptic cleft, and a postsynaptic cell, one that we're communicating with. And I know that when we talk about how neurotransmitters work, we always say that that neurotransmitter, like acetylcholine, binds to a receptor, right? And what happens when that receptor binds acetylcholine?
It opens
up a channel, right? And then you get all this activity change on the inside of your cell. So what if there was no receptor? Could acetylcholine talk to that cell? No, there'd be no conversation, right? Okay, hold that thought and then look at this picture here on direct gene activation. There's a receptor for that protein hormone. It's sitting on the plasma membrane. And notice it looks like a pretty good fit between the receptor site and the shape of that hormone. If there was no receptor sitting there on that plasma membrane, what do you think that hormone would do to that cell? Nothing. No, it's like having a house with no doorbell, right? Okay, if you didn't think to knock, you would just keep on walking. And that's what the hormone does. The hormone says, hey, I have no way to ring your doorbell, and you won't ever know that I'm out here with a message for you, so I just keep on going. Okay, so you've got to have a receptor there in order for that hormone to be able to initiate conversation. Now, that hormone is going to be called our first messenger. Keep in mind, this process is called a secondary or a second messenger system. Now, why is it that hormone can't travel into your cell?
It doesn't have a bind.
Yeah, why can't that protein hormone just come on in the cell?
Too big.
Yeah. So it's too big. It would kill the cell by ripping a hole in the membrane. So that protein is kept on the outside surface. Okay. So when it finds a receptor, it binds the receptor, and that's as good as sending the message into the interior of the cell. Okay. Notice what happens inside the cell. A couple of things are turned on here. We're not going to focus too much on G protein. We are going to focus, though, on this thing called CAMP. And CAMP is going to serve as our second messenger. Okay, keep in mind the process is called the secondary messenger system. And something called CAMP is going to serve as our second messenger. Now, CAMP stands for cyclic AMP. I just want to tell you this simply because it's a relative of ATP. And what is ATP?
Energy.
Energy, right. So AMP is actually adenosine monophosphate. It's a real low-level energy molecule. So I just want to tell you that so you kind of have something to relate it to. Okay, so let's start from the beginning. Along comes your protein hormone. It's too big. It can't travel into your cell. It happens upon a cell that has a receptor for it on the outside surface. Because the hormone and the cell have a pretty good lock and key fit, the hormone binds the receptor, and that now turns on the creation of CAMP inside the cell. CAMP inside the cell is your second messenger. Okay? So CAMP carries out the hormone's wishes inside the cell. This hormone actually is going to activate something called protein kinase. Notice that A-S-E ending. What does that remind you of?
Enzyme,
right. What do enzymes do?
Speed up,
right. So thinking big picture here, I know you guys have talked about epinephrine and adrenaline and stuff like that before. What is one of the things that epinephrine makes speed up in your body?
Heart rate, yeah.
So this could be a heart muscle cell. And it turns on CAMP to tell protein kinase to tell this cell, hey, speed up your activities. And so that may be one of the effects of one of these protein-based hormones. So whether it is an increased rate of mitosis or just to run the metabolism faster, the message is, you know, I want you to do something for me inside the cell as soon as that protein hormone docks on the outside surface. Okay, so let me give you an analogy as to how this works. What if I had a pet elephant? And my pet elephant grew to 25 feet, and he's several tons. But, you know, my pet elephant would like to come in the house and play. Okay. Not happening, right? Because pet elephant is
too big.
Too big. Okay. When pet elephant was a baby, we trained him to ring the doorbell, and that told us what he wanted. So when pet elephant rings the doorbell, he is behaving as what?
First messenger,
right. And by ringing the doorbell, it is binding with the receptor, right. And inside the house, because we know what pet elephant wants, maybe it's peanuts, maybe it's somebody to play outside, whatever the case is. Once that doorbell is rung, the second messenger is turned on. Okay, so who might the second messenger be? You, right? So you say, ah, pet elephant's ringing the doorbell, time to get the peanuts, or time to go outside and play. And you serve as camp. And so what does camp do inside the cell? Find somebody to play with. Turn on the enzymes, right? So camp is just a piece of the puzzle in getting the next step to roll, which is, hey, get the activity to change here. So we need to do something in response to having that doorbell rung. As long as that doorbell is ringing, camp is working for you, right? You stop ringing the doorbell, we're done inside, right? So as long as somebody rings your doorbell at your house, you're going to go look and see who's out there. They stop ringing, you stop looking, okay? So if you've ever heard of drugs called blockers, alpha blockers, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, those drugs block hormones or neurotransmitters by putting a safety plug right there in that receptor site. So when the hormone is looking for somebody to bind to, it says, I don't see anything there, and it keeps on going to the next cell. And so that way it has no communication with that cell. So kind of a cool concept. It's like those safety plugs you put in outlets for kids. Okay, does that one make pretty good sense? So what kinds of hormones use the secondary messenger system? Proteins, right. And what behaves as your first messenger? Hormone, good. And your second messenger is?
Camp,
good. All right. Let's see, we also have direct gene activation. There's a blank if you have a worksheet. And of course, this time there's a receptor, but it's inside the cell. That blank is for the word intracellular. Okay, so there's a blank there, intracellular. So this particular method of direct gene activation is how lipids or steroid hormones talk to their target cells. And so we're looking at adrenal gland hormones, and we're looking at sex hormones like testosterone and estrogen. So these hormones, of course, are released by the organ into the bloodstream. They travel around your body, and when they encounter cells with these receptors inside them, then they communicate with those cells only. No receptor, there's no communication to be had. So what is it about the lipid? Can they travel through the plasma membrane?
Yes.
Yeah, so lipids can go through the plasma membrane. They're small enough, and the plasma membrane agrees with their chemistry. So these lipid hormones just come right on into your cells. Notice where the intracellular receptor is located. It's inside the nucleus. So not only do these hormones come in your cell, they come into your business office. And they come in there and they say, I got a message for you. I mean, talk about being bold, right? Walk right on into your nucleus with your message. That's where they bind the receptor, and that's where they start targeting a piece of the DNA. So they actually activate protein synthesis. What does protein synthesis make? Makes RNA out here in the cytoplasm. We're making proteins, right? Okay. So I know that you knew before you came to this class that what does testosterone make happen for men? Hair grow, right? Voice changes, right? Muscle growth also relies on testosterone. So using that one as an example, when testosterone comes into the cell, binds a receptor, turns on protein synthesis, it may in fact encourage hair growth or muscle growth or changes in, say, vocal cords, things of that sort. So we know that protein synthesis is activated in part when we've got lipid hormones coming into our cells. Okay?
Now, you said that thyroxine uses the direct gene activation, right?
It does.
Exactly how does that work?
It's going to have to shed an iodine atom to come in, so it kind of drops a piece of its luggage as it comes in, and then it's going to bind a receptor that activates metabolism changes inside the cell.
Okay.
So it actually has to have an escort to get to the cell in the first place. It's an odd hormone. It's not like the rest of ours. So, okay, so one difference here that you see so far is that protein synthesis is activated in part due to a lipid hormone present at a cell. Notice back here with secondary messenger, we didn't turn on protein synthesis. We just turned on an enzyme to change the activity in the cell. Okay, so if you had a test question that said, what type of hormone activates protein synthesis? It'd be your lipid-based hormones. Okay, so they're the ones that are going to turn on that. Kind of going back and using an analogy again, if you live next door to a really close friend, or maybe it's a relative that lives next door to you, if they need to borrow a cup of sugar or even a roll of toilet paper, they may just come in your house without ringing your doorbell, help themselves and leave, right? Okay, that's kind of what a lipid hormone does. It doesn't knock, it comes on in, it helps itself to whatever needs to be done, and it goes right into the nucleus to activate DNA transcription into RNA. So it's a rather bold move, but that's the way lipid hormones work. Okay, so that should take us down to the bottom of page 4. Do y'all have any questions so far? Anything I can clarify for you?
When you said that the thyroxine has to shift to iodine molecule, is that when it goes into 4-2-3?
That's correct. That's right, because sometimes that conversion down to T3 is inefficient, and sometimes they check the free T4s that are not being escorted by thyroglobulin to see if you've got enough being escorted in the bloodstream and that kind of thing. So exactly right. Good. And we'll get into a lot more detail in probably a little bit in this chapter, a little bit later on. Yeah. Just to hit a little bit on the top of the next page, we'll see if we can finish that page 5 up, and that'll do us pretty good for today. Just want to introduce three terms to you: permissiveness, synergism, and antagonism. In terms of how hormones communicate with each other, some are what we call permissive, and what that means is one hormone may have to be present to allow another hormone to do its job. So sometimes when women are trying to get pregnant, they may go to a doctor's office, they may run tests, and the woman may go home not with sex hormones, but with a thyroid hormone prescription. And what thyroid hormone does is it gives permission for sex hormones to do their job. So if you increase thyroxine levels, then sex hormones can now come and work. Same thing works with breastfeeding. Oxytocin gives permission for prolactin to be able to work. So we're looking at some relationships there between hormones where one has to be present for another one to come in and be able to function. What do you think that synergist as hormones do? Work together. Do you think they have same outcomes or different?
Same.
Yeah, they should have same or similar outcomes. And antagonist have?
Different.
Different, yeah, good. That was easy, okay? And then middle of your page there, on page 5 that is, there are three types of stimuli that can arouse an endocrine gland to release its hormones. I know a lot of you are moms, and maybe you breastfed a baby, and you didn't want to go anywhere that somebody had babies crying, right? Because what would happen to you?
Start leaking.
Start leaking, yep. So your brain, your neural system, right, got triggered by a baby crying, and that turned on hormones like oxytocin to start the breast milk production process. So which of these three do you think I'm describing? Turned on your brain.
Neural.
Yeah. All you had to do was hear that baby, right? That's neural. Let's see. Let's do another one. If we are talking about having blood glucose levels be too high or too low, we talk about the pancreas regulating blood glucose levels. The pancreas is going to release insulin or glucagon based on what it needs to do to fix the blood glucose levels in terms of regulating it within a narrow range in your body. I keep saying blood over and over, and that's my clue word for humoral. Good. So back in the 16 and 1700s, I don't know where they got this word from, but they called them the humors. Bile, saliva, blood, your bodily fluids were called your humors, and the word has stuck. So when we're talking about blood concentration of calcium, glucose, sodium, potassium, look for that blood concentration to be regulating a hormone output. That is humoral stimulation of an organ. Last, some of our hormones are regulated by other hormones. For instance, I know in lab you guys have talked about TRH coming from the hypothalamus. It tells the anterior pituitary to release TSH. That is one hormone telling another gland what hormone to release. That is kind of a pass the buck down the line. That is hormonal control. Notice the spelling is really similar to humoral, but they work totally different. Blood concentration of something, glucose, calcium, or whatever, is going to stimulate hormone production under humoral control. But hormonal control is when one gland controls output of another gland's hormones. Okay, question.
Well, the hormonal interactions, can you be for aggressiveness and be a synergistic at the same time?
You could, like oxytocin and prolactin, absolutely. Yep, sure could. I sent you guys an email yesterday probably about this stuff, anterior pituitary and hypothalamus relationship. I think this is probably one of the toughest topics in this chapter. If you didn't get the email, know that not everybody's in D2L yet, or maybe is having issues with your email, check out my announcement in D2L. It gives you something to work on over the weekend. I think it will make our time spent here on Tuesday better if you have a preview of these anterior pituitary and hypothalamus hormones. Do you all have any questions for today? All right, I will see you on Tuesday.